Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:26 p.m. that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is January 25th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. What we've certainly seen in here today was a turn to risk on, where the dollar has pulled back. The U.S. 10-year Treasury price is down by about 10 ticks, but the yield is up 35 basis points. The yen was also a little weaker in here today. So that has the other side of the ledger then has been a strong rally on Wall Street. The vast majority of stock markets, precious metals are up, the industrial resources are up, and generally speaking, we have a more of a risk on tone. So what are the major points? Well, there was an early move today in terms of the government shutdown in the USA. LaGuardia started refusing flights because they didn't have enough of security personnel. So that, I think, lit a fire under the politicians to come to some form of at least interim agreement, and that is in fact what has been announced. So the dollar was in negative territory in here today. It completely countermanded the move that we saw yesterday. That's certainly some support coming through for the euro because of a dearth of safe haven demand for the dollar. And that upward dynamic is the biggest upward dynamic we've seen for the euro in quite a while, at least since the beginning of the year, and it suggests at least some support coming through at the lower side of the range. So we're still in a very, I think, choppy but narrow choppy environment between the euro and the dollar. There is a consensus among institutional investors that the dollar should be declining. And there has been some amazement, and certainly I've been questioning just why the 10-year price has been so firm, because there is such an enormous amount of debt that needs to be refinanced and indeed issued this year. Well, we're continuing to see that the bond price has been coming back down, but I think the major levels here are 121, which is the upper side of the underlying trading range, and I think by the time the price gets back there, that will also coincide with the region of the trend mean. We won't really have clear confirmation of a return to demand dominance beyond short-term steadying for a return to supply dominance beyond some short-term steadying until we see the price coming back below the trend mean. Then, of course, we have this big question about where is the liquidity going to come from to fuel the next big advance? And I thought that today it would be instructive to just look at the individual balance sheets of the primary central banks to get an idea of exactly what is going on, rather than simply rely on news. Let's just simply look at the charts. And the Federal Reserve's bank balance sheet has been coming down. Now, what I find particularly interesting is that there's comparatively little talk from the Fed about just how much they want to reduce the size of their balance sheet. And I tend to think that it's probably going to end somewhere around 3 to 3.5 trillion. Because if you think about the constituents of that balance sheet, well, they've absorbed the entire mortgage book of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the mortgage originators for the federal government. So that supply of mortgage bonds is can't simply be released into the market. They have to rely on prepayments, and that's not something that is likely to accelerate beyond the pace of economic growth. So they're really stuck with those mortgage bonds. Then you have the fact that they need to have sufficient capital in the or at least sufficient liquidity in the market to ensure the smooth operation of the economy. So that used to be about $1 trillion before 2008. It's probably more than that now. Then, of course, you have the fact that the Federal Reserve is paying interest on deposits from the US Treasury, for one thing, and then also from the banking sector. So that's probably at least another $1 trillion. So we're probably then thinking that the excess that the Federal Reserve can realistically remove from the market, we're probably about halfway there. That's potentially an interesting figure, because the Federal Reserve will probably end up removing about $1 trillion from circulation. They may go a bit more than that, but that was almost exactly the same amount of money that the ECB removed from circulation back in 2012 through 2014. And we know what happened on that occasion, that massive removal of liquidity provoked a deflationary spiral. And the remedial action that needed to be taken to arrest that decline resulted in the size of the ECB's balance sheet going from 2 to 2.6 trillion. Well, what's particularly interesting in here right now is that certainly the pace of the ECB's balance sheet expansion has moderated, but there is no evidence that it has stopped. And that is completely contrary to what the ECB said they were going to do at the end of last year. So that's rather interesting. My phone has just started talking to me, so at least that suggests that somebody is listening. When we look at the ECB's balance sheet, in fact, the pace of the expansion has started to accelerate again since the beginning of this year. Well, this is a testament to just how weak the European economy is, that it is in no way near a position where it can do without that liquidity. There are simply too many questions that are outstanding with regard to what exactly is going on in the European economy. You have, for example, German PMI figures that are back below 50. So Germany was able to squeak past and get a positive growth figure for the fourth quarter of 2018, but growth has certainly slowed down. If you think, where are its exports going? Well, they're going to the rest of Europe, and the rest of Europe is not exactly growing aggressively. And then the USA is another major destination. And then you have China, where you definitely have some slowing. So that is a significant headwind to major exporters like Germany. Then in France, you have continued rather vociferous protests against the government. You have the potential for the yellow vests to start running for positions in the European elections. There is the very real possibility that the European elections in 2019 are going to deliver a parliament that it has a significant swing to the populist right, or indeed to the populist left, or indeed both. But what it is further evidence of is the potential that the centre is no longer going to hold. Because what has defined centrism in Europe for the last 40 years has been social democracy. And that is no longer functioning as a way of improving standards of living, for the simple reason that the taking on massive quantities of debt to offset the loss of living standards from the erosion of the manufacturing base is no longer something that can really continue, because the size of the debt load has become so large, and also because the massive debt accumulation as a result of the sovereign wealth crisis has exacerbated what would have been probably a process that could have gone on for at least a while longer. So we're still working through the headache from the last crisis in Europe, and interest rates are still at very low levels, and there is very little prospect that the ECB is going to be raising their interest rates anytime soon. Certainly, it won't be within Mario Draghi's tenure. We'll have to see exactly who the next central banker is in Europe, but they would be insane to appoint anyone other than a dove. And that does hold out the prospect that we are going to see additional monetary accommodation. And certainly, what we're seeing on this chart is that it has already begun. And that's really good news for stock markets. If this is a liquidity-fueled bull market, well, we need to see sources of fresh liquidity, and the ECB is certainly providing that. So that is really quite good news. If we the question I've been asking for nearly 3 months is, where is the next big source of liquidity going to come from? Well, the ECB is certainly a potential source of liquidity, and that capital is both global and mobile. So, the more of it that they print, the greater the influence it's going to have on asset prices, but perhaps more importantly, perceptions of asset price inflation. Now, let's take a look at what's going on in Japan. Well, the Bank of Japan's balance sheet has been accelerating higher since 2012, and the pace of the advance has moderated. But it is still rising, and as long as it is continuing to rise, that is perhaps not as powerful a tailwind as it was previously, but neither is it a headwind. Of course, what people will be looking at is the potential for the yen to either rise or fall. And when we look at the yen in here today, it spent most of the day, in fact, in negative territory, but it did strengthen up towards the end of the session. There was that flash rally at the beginning of this year, and it is quite normal to see after a move like that. If we go back and think about the flash crashes we've had in the stock market, that it does have a deleterious effect on sentiment, and it probably, I think, helps to really confirm bullishness among the Japanese bulls. So there's the potential here that it will rally back towards the highs seen at the right at the beginning of this year. That is probably something that is individual to the yen, whereas we've seen more of a risk-on environment taking hold in asset prices right across other sectors. Now, when we look at what is going on in China, well, the central bank has been certainly weighing on the shadow banking sector. And this total has not been updated since the 31st of December. So we're only going to get an update on exactly what the Chinese Central Bank is doing probably at the end of this month. And it's probably also reported in arrears. I think that's certainly something to bear in mind when we look at this data. But it is still trending higher, and it was at a new all-time high in December. So I think that's rather important that the Chinese are still stimulating. I did find this rather interesting graphic in here today, and it really does do a great job of highlighting just how exposed the commercial banking sector was to the shadow banks back in 2016 and 17, and what a significant job of deleveraging has been done in 2017 and 18. Now, if we think about where that peak was in terms of shadow banking influence and calls on the conventional banking sector back in 2016 and 2017, and then look at the pace of the central bank expansion since then. So they have, on the one hand, tried to take some money out of the shadow banking sector, and they've been trying to allay at least part of that contraction by expanding the balance sheet. So That's, I think, potentially important. Then, of course, you have the fact that having now unwound all of that exposure to the shadow banking sector, they've also banned new US dollar denominated debt that was capped at perhaps $450 billion in 2017. So the Chinese do have the room now to start to stimulate once more. Now they have reduced the reserve requirements on the banks. So that is a positive. Then when we look at the banking sector, it has rallied over the course of the last few sessions to test the region of the trend mean. So there is some evidence of support starting to come through in here. Then I think it is perhaps it might just be viewed as a straw in the wind, but when we look at Tencent, the fact that they've had two of their newer games have been permissioned, but perhaps not their most important, and then also the big success stories of last year, which are certainly is Fortnite, which is obviously a US company, has not been permissioned. But it is, I think, important to highlight that when we think about the reason why Tencent had been pulling back last year, it was because the Communist Party had become rather alarmed at the pervasiveness and of the gaming communities, that games are very engrossing. They tend to create their own communities. Those communities cross boundaries, whether it is class, race, or language. In many respects, that people just like to congregate together to play these games. And it's all on a virtual marketplace. Well, that could also be a forum for dissension, and that's certainly what we saw with the joke site last year. So there is that was certainly one of the issues that was assailing Tencent. So they have been brought to heel, and now some of the pressure that was coming to bear has been lifted. So the share has now broken its progression of lower rally highs, having just about halved. And that is, I think, important because Tencent is such a totem for the Hong Kong market. So the H share index is now back above the trend mean and pressuring its progression of higher reaction lows. When we look at some of those consumer companies that have been pulling back over the course of the last few years, well, for example, Hengan International is still trending down, but at least it is in a reversionary rally right now. Wantwant is one of the biggest producers of snack foods, and there, if I go to our pantry, we certainly have some of those in our house, and it is now back above the trend mean. But this is also a share that has had base formation characteristics for the last few years. The valuation is still not quite as attractive as one might want, but at least some of the selling pressure has abated in the share. For example, when we look at Great Wall, then obviously we've had a great deal of pressure coming to bear on the automotive sector, but there is definitely evidence here of Great Wall having lost downward momentum, and it is now also back in the region of the trend mean. Then Lenovo was one of the primary technology companies in China before it had a crushing decline in 2015, but it increasingly has first step above the base characteristics, and it's been consolidating above its trend mean for 3 months already. Baidu has also been pulling back, and it's starting to firm at least from the $150 region. So I think these are rather important points that there are a significant number of Chinese companies have at least lost downward momentum against a background where the The Chinese administration has an incentive to try and start to support some of these companies once more. The economy is slowing, and some of the most overleveraged of the property markets are under pressure. The consumer in China is really feeling the pressure as well. So obviously the consumer does not represent as large a weighting in the Chinese economy as it does elsewhere, but it's still now a meaningful part of the economy, and it needs to be continued to be fostered if they're going to build up their reliance on their domestic economy relative to the risks that China is exposed to by slowing global growth. So they do definitely need to do something to support the domestic economy, and there is the realistic possibility that they can just declare victory against the shadow banking sector and start to stimulate, albeit in a perhaps more targeted fashion. So I think that is potentially rather important in here. Now, I had an email in here today, and it was asking an important question about the outlook for the corporate bond markets. And when we look at the fact that there are a substantial number of bonds that are in the BBB and BBB minus brackets, so that's really very considerable. And when we think about the outlook for the bond markets, we know that there is a wall of new debt that needs to be issued, both in the treasury markets and in the credit markets. So that holds out the prospect that we're going to have indigestion. And that's generally supportive of the argument that we should have higher yields, and that the significant pullback that we had in the yield at the end of last year was in large part due to safe haven buying as a result of the increased volatility that we saw on the stock market. If that is true, then this yield will push back above the trend mean, and it will push back above the 3% level and persist in rallying from there. If that contention is false and we are moving into a much more uncertain environment with slower growth, then the yield will not sustain a move above the trend mean or above 3%. So we're at a rather interesting period here for these government bond prices, or indeed yields. What I think some people, and certainly we're starting to see, is that there is demand for reliable dividend income. And there are a number of reasons for that. The first, of course, is because people are worried about the outlook for the bond markets, and the very real potential that significant large companies are going to be downgraded because they have built up so much leverage and are going to have a more difficult time competing with both the government and other companies for available capital to refinance their debt amid a higher yielding environment. That is a realistic possibility. So what are the kinds of companies that can deliver dividend income but do not have a great deal of outstanding debt? Well, I'm going to post a spreadsheet of those kinds of companies in comment of the day today. And but when we simply click through it, Samsung, for example, or Intel really stand out as big technology companies. Novartis as a significant pharmaceuticals company, and Walt Disney as a big consumer company. Rio Tinto certainly also stands out as a significant position, and there are a number of financial type companies, although a comparatively small number of actual banks. Then of course the tobacco companies really stand out as well, and then you have holding companies like Jardine Strategic. Well, in the subscribers audio over the course of the last few weeks, I've been talking about the outperformance of ASEAN, and One thing that I think stands out is that Jardine Strategic has gone nowhere for 5 years, but it is now consolidating in a reasonably bullish fashion in the region of the trend mean, and this share is trading on a price to book of 0.7 and a price to sales of 0.7 as well. Then its debt to assets is about 15%, and its debt to equity is about 40%. So it's not over-levered. Its cash generated, the cash required is 2.7, and it's well covered in terms of its dividends at 22 times. So we're talking about a cash-rich company that is in one of the most high-growth regions of the world and throwing off in the order of 2.6 to, or at least 2 billion. Dollars of free cash flow. So these are the kinds of companies that should do well in any kind of environment because they're unlevered and they're comparatively cheap on an objective financial basis. Then, of course, you have the kinds of companies that have pulled back violently over the last year, and but they don't have a lot of debt. So Continental Tire would be one of those, and it is unwinding its oversold condition relative to the trend mean right now. Then what I found particularly interesting was that there were a number of home builders fell into this spreadsheet as well, and Persimmon was one of those, and this has been a very impressive rebound. What I found particularly interesting when looking at it somewhat more closely was that they have no debt. And when you look at it perhaps even a little bit more closely, it's not exactly true they have no debt because they do have an outstanding loan. But that loan is for 483 million, whereas the market cap is 7.6 billion. So that tells us that this is, in fact, a rather cheap company paying an outsized dividend. And in the potential outcome that the UK is going to remain closer to the EU than many people thought or indeed wished for, then that's potentially positive for Persimmon because it removes some of the uncertainty. So there is certainly the potential here that these kinds of companies can sustain their dividends. And then, of course, you have companies that don't pay dividends at all, but they don't have any debt either. And Facebook is one of those, and it has now broken its sequence of lower rally highs. So that is a really rather significant trend in downtrend inconsistency, and it suggests that at least some support beyond the short term has now been found. And when we look at Google, well, it hasn't quite yet been able to break up and out of its range, but it is looking increasingly likely that it will in fact be able to do so. So it at least has held this $1,000 area, and that's rather positive. I rather think that we're probably going to see some additional ranging, but if this turns into one of the more lengthy ranges, similar to what we saw, for example, between 2014 and the middle of 2015, then that could be viewed as the best of all possible worlds. So certainly, we have seen an uptick in interest from stock markets over the course of today. Now, when we look at the major stock markets, then the S&P 500 was in positive territory in here today, and it's been ranging now for most of this week. It is starting to price in the potential that the federal government is going to open back up, that the trade war with China, at least the intensity of it, is going to moderate, or at least that they will agree to keep talking and suspend additional tariffs until they're done talking. That at least would be reasonable. And the index is right in the region of the trend mean after what has been a very impressive rebound. It is unlikely that the market is going to go straight back up to 3,000 and then straight up and out of this corrective phase that began a year ago. But as long as it holds the lows around 2350, put in right at the on Boxing Day, then that suggests that we are in a corrective phase, but that it is a rangy phase rather than something to worry about immediately. But the fact is that the stock market is a pricing tool. It prices in the potential of what we can expect about a year out. So that incredibly impressive advance that we had in 2016 and 2017 was pricing in the rate cuts, excuse me, it was pricing in the tax cuts and the repatriation of money from overseas and the reducing regulation. The decline that we saw in 2018 was in response to the fact that the Federal Reserve is reducing the size of its balance sheet. So now the rebound that we're getting is perhaps in response more to the fact that it's unlikely the Federal Reserve is going to raise rates again, and that is potentially a that is, I think, something that it could at least help to support markets in the short term. But we have to think about the medium term, because this big period of volatility we've had over the last 12 months is pricing in a more difficult economic environment in 2019. That's why it's unlikely the Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates, because growth is likely to moderate. Now, when we think about the outlook for the liquidity-fueled environment, Europe and China are the epicenters of risk, and therefore they are the places where we can anticipate the greatest appetite for additional stimulus to start to arise from. The USA is not as enthusiastic about additional stimulus for the simple reason that the consumer has delevered, that they've had a substantial amount of asset price inflation. The Federal Reserve is very committed to trying to reload its interest rate weapon before they have the next need to use it. So that is one of the conditions that is leading to continued reductions in the size of the balance sheet. As I said at the outset, I do think that an additional 500 billion is about as much as they could possibly remove from the balance sheet, which would take them up to the end of this year. And at that point, then the stock market might well indeed be starting to price in either the potential for an additional slowdown or a recession. So, what happens in terms of the global economy and how successful China and Europe are in trying to stoke, I think, demand is going to be a significant factor. Then, if we're concentrating on these liquidity measures, then high yield spreads are continuing to contract. They're down to 15 basis points. And if we zoom in and just look at that on the daily basis, well, we know that the spread has been ranging below 20 basis points for the last almost 2 months, and that had been the previous area of support. So this does look like still a consistent downtrend. And I think that's what we're likely to see, is that the Federal Reserve is going to continue to remove liquidity until they have evidence that they should really stop. And they should really stop if they start to see unemployment spiking, or if they start to see the banking sector coming under significant stress. Well, when we look at the banking sector, for example, then it has now unwound just about all of its overextension relative to the trend mean, and it was in positive territory again today. Perhaps the regional banking sector is more of a better arbiter of exactly what's going on in the domestic economy, and that hasn't quite yet unwound all of its oversold condition. When we look at high yield spreads, then the spread has been contracting, and it was likely in additional negative territory in here today. if we look at the ETF, the iBox or the iShares iBox ETF, then it was in positive territory in here today, but it is consolidating in the region of the trend mean. Today was certainly a positive day for the majority of these stock markets, and that was also the case for gold. With less demand coming through for the dollar, then that was a green light for gold investors. So gold is now pulling away from the region of the trend mean, and it is coming, I think it is likely to come right back up and test the upper side of this range. Well, that's, I think, evidence of continued demand for some form of safe haven that cannot be manipulated by central banks. If we think about when does gold do best? Well, it tends to do best when you have negative real interest rates. In other words, that inflation is rising faster than central banks are willing to raise them. And there is an argument that we have that in Europe today, that the inflation measure has been pretty sticky, and it's unlikely the ECB is going to raise interest rates. Well, we've had stealth inflation underway in the USA for the last decade with massive asset price inflation, but that is not in how the central bank is measuring the inflation. So gold is more of a reflection of what's going on out there in the real world. Central banks are looking increasingly likely that they are going to have to stimulate. The uncertainty that has helped to stoke demand for the dollar is abating, so that is resulting in some easiness coming through in the dollar. What I think is particularly interesting is that despite the fact that we've had reasonably small moves in the dollar, gold is responding in a very emphatic fashion. And we haven't really seen this kind of emphatic move in gold in a while. So that's something that I think really does stand out. What is also particularly interesting is when we look at the gold miners, because they have been inert and they have been waiting for some evidence that gold prices could start to be revised upwards once more. So the gold mining index is still comparatively cheap. We've also seen something that we see at the bottom of lots of bear markets is some really large consolidation. So with Barrick buying Rand Gold Resources and with the merger between Newmont or Newmont's purchase, then what that's also highlighting for us is that the big companies would rather buy their competitors today than invest in new exploration. There are two big reasons for that. The first is that their competitors, as well as themselves, are quite cheap at these levels. So that makes a value proposition. But then it's about grading, because the high-grade ore has been mined. And even the biggest new mines that are being found, they're not on a scale that is large enough to really generate interest. So the easy way to really get access to good resources is to buy them from someone who's already sunk all the capital into the projects to get them off the ground. So that's reducing the number of companies that are existing in the business. And that removal of supply from the market is something that we see at the bottom of just about every bear market. So it's, I think, very clearly an argument that we could see gold prices starting to do substantially better from here. That if we think then about what is gold doing, not just in dollars, because obviously it is coming back up towards the upper side of its range against the the US dollar. And I think it is appropriate to look at it in since about 2011 when we had the peak. So, for example, the Aussie dollar was in positive territory in here today, but gold was in more positive territory. And there is a real possibility here that the gold price is going to break on the upside versus the Aussie dollar. That also is a testament to some of the issues that are arising with the Australian economy. But in Brazilian real, gold is also on the cusp of breaking on the upside. And exactly the same situation in terms of Canadian dollars. Now, when we look at it in terms of Swiss francs, then it has rallied more against the Swiss franc than it has against the dollar and is also right at the upper side of its range. We're coming up towards the Chinese New Year. In fact, it's going to be in about 10 days' time. This is, generally speaking, a firm time for bond, for excuse me, for gold purchases in China, and gold prices do look like they are going to be able to break back above that 9,000 renminbi level. When we look at it against the euro, then it has broken its sequence of lower rally highs, despite the fact that the pound has been resurgent over the course of the last week. Gold was well off its lows in here this week. When we look at it in terms of Indonesian rupiah, then gold hasn't really looked back. It's been ranging higher over the course of the last 5 years. And then you, of course, have Indian rupee, where it has cleared the 90,000 rupee level. Well, one of the things that we've talked about at this service for much of the period when gold prices were doing very well was that gold does best when it's appreciating in all currencies, because gold is a monetary metal. So, if it is considered a currency, then you can't talk about a currency as being strong or weak until you compare it against something else. And if gold is in fact a monetary metal, and it is, considering that central banks the world over hold it as a reserve currency, then if it is appreciating in all currencies, that is generally when we get some of the most impressive moves. So I think that's where we're starting to see some clear arguments coming through here that gold has been out of favor for a very long time, and now we are back in a position where it can start to do better. The other point, of course, is that ranges are explosions waiting to happen. So we have just seen that there are an awful lot of ranges in the gold market. So when we think about that, what investors are now starting to price in is that we are moving increasingly towards a period where currencies are going to be debased. Whether that is as a result of inflation or deflation is rather beside the point, because if we have deflation, then central banks are going to be printing more money in order to try and combat the deflation. And deflation also means that we will have negative real interest rates. In fact, a deflationary environment is much better for gold than an inflationary environment, because in an inflationary environment, then inflation has to keep rising faster than the ability of central banks to raise interest rates, whereas there is a natural negative bound to where interest rates can fall to in a deflationary environment. If we do have an inflationary environment, then it is the value of hard assets that tends to do best. Well, that's certainly gold and the other commodities. What I found particularly interesting in here today was that the industrial metals are starting to firm, and that's particularly true of copper prices. And Copper today was up in a dynamic manner, and it's pushing back up towards the region of the upper side of its range. Tin prices have also started to steady in here. They're coming back up towards the upper side of their range, and that range has been going on for 2 years. Nickel prices, having trended down for most of last year, have now broken the sequence of lower rally highs. What is also interesting is that when we look at what's been going on in Congo, obviously there have been some questions about the validity of the election, but we have had a peaceful transition of power, or at least so far, and that has had a really quite deleterious effect on cobalt prices. So that is one commodity that is coming down rather swiftly in price. So that, I think, is one of the issues that we are one of the primary points that really stands out. We are definitely starting to see a change in terms of the demand for resources, and the FTSE 350 mining index is back above the trend mean. When we look at some of those individual miners, then Rio Tinto is back above the trend mean and pressuring that 4,000 level. It has one of the higher dividends around. It's around 5.93%, and it's been growing that dividend pretty steadily since 2016. BHP has some energy exposure, but it is also now back above the trend mean, and it's broken the sequence of lower rally highs since early in 2018. So this is a positive performance, and BHP Billiton had to cut its dividend in 2016, so it is no longer an S&P 350 dividend aristocrat, but it is back to paying dividends, and that dividend payout has climbed back to where it used to be in 2015. So this is a share that is currently yielding about 5.5% if you strip out the special cash dividend that was paid or announced in December. So these are shares that are cash generative and that are generally tending to do somewhat better. Now, Glencore, with its focus on coal and and indeed nickel and cobalt, has been underperforming for the last 12 months, but it has also steadied in here. Thinking of the coal sector, XRO in South Africa has been holding this sequence of higher major reaction lows over the course of the last 3 years, and it has paused for 12 months below 16,000 rand, but it also has one of the most attractive dividends around. And that dividend growth rate over the course of the last 18 months has been particularly impressive. So quite whether that is sustainable when it's kicking off these very big interim dividends is rather questionable, but the trend is hard to argue with. So we are certainly seeing some evidence of demand for the resources. Now, one of the more important points, quite apart from the fact that these are comparatively cheap, they have got strong dividends, and they are leveraged to global growth. Now, against a global growth environment which has been slowing, the fact that we are now starting to see these resources sectors starting to pick up again, well, what that suggests is that there are improving signs that more central banks are going to be engaged in stimulus. This is, in fact, one of the things that I personally have been waiting to see. We've been through really quite an aggressive contraction over the course of the last few months. Now we're starting to see central banks becoming more active, and we're starting to see the kinds of sectors that are leveraged to global growth turning back to performance. That's particularly true of the resources sector. Then, of course, resources and cyclical sectors generally do tend to do better in the latter stages of cyclical bull markets, as cyclical sectors. So there is clear evidence that we might see more of that. that there is the potential that the biotech sector is also going to start doing better. Technology historically has been a highly cyclical sector. That's much less true today of the major technology companies that that represent the big weightings in the NASDAQ, because the subscription business model has smoothened out their cash flows. By and large, the biotech sector is highly cyclical because it's dependent on the permissioning of individual drugs, and as those drugs enter the market, you get a surge of additional cash flow, and then you have to go off and find the next one. So it's an inherently cyclical business. And when you start to see demand for these cyclical businesses, well, then that is representative of demand that is, I suppose, gives us an indication that it's towards the latter stages of an advance. Now, when we look at Europe, well, the European market was in positive territory today, and it is unwinding its oversold condition relative to the trend mean. And there are individual portions of the European market that are attractive, and that is particularly those that have got big global franchises and that have got low debt and good records of dividend yields. But the domestic economy in Europe is really in dire straits, because Europe needs a federal transfer mechanism, and it doesn't have one. And that really holds out the potential that Europe is going to have a number of false dawns economically, but it's unlikely to be able to break out of its funk for very long until it tackles its debt problems. And there is just no prospect of that until we see, I think, clear evidence of a migration towards a federal Europe. That's certainly the plan of Brussels. Quite whether they have any chance of getting that past even one parliament in the EU is an entirely different prospect. And that is the basic rationale behind Brexit. Now, the pound today was in really quite firm territory, and it closed back above 115 against the euro. If we get upside follow through next week, and I rather think it's unlikely, we are probably due some consolidation considering just how quickly the pound has rallied over the last 2 weeks. But if we do see upside follow through next week, well, then we're talking about base formation completion. And that would remove the biggest source of worry that people have had about the pound over the course of the last 3 years. It really does come down to governance is everything. And when we take a look around the world, we've had this rise of populism. But rise of populism is too simplistic for what we've started to see globally, that it is a complete disillusion with the status quo. And just like a range is an explosion waiting to happen, then what we are seeing in the political front is that this inertia in terms of political movement that we've had for the last 40 years is resulting in a move to the fringes, whether that is extreme left or extreme right. And that process is going to persist, because if we simply think about it in terms of a Hegelian or a didactic way of thinking, that you have the problem that, and it takes time to reach a synthesis, that is going to take a significant period of discussion, experimentation, and renewal in the democracies of the world. This is a process is also happening elsewhere, but in highly stratified societies where you have totalitarianism, then that creates a pressure cooker environment, and eventually if the totalitarian regime cannot deliver on the promises that is made, well, it becomes progressively more fragile, and then they eventually break. And that's perhaps most likely in countries where you have large young populations. That is one of the reasons why you had the Arab Spring evolving in the Middle East first, because they have very large young populations in a totalitarian regime. So, when we look around the world, China is a totalitarian regime, but has comparatively few young people as a proportion of the population. That is, in fact, a stabilizing effect. Then you have India, and India's population of about 1.3 to 1.4 billion has half of those people under the age of 25. So, India has got the potential to have an incredible demographic dividend. If we're thinking about where is manufacturing going to migrate to if the trade war between the USA and China were in fact to deteriorate further, India has got to be the number one potential destination because it is where the largest pool of young, cheap labor exists. And that represents a really very significant bullish phenomenon for the Indian market. So I suspect that India is going to be a buy on the dips for decades to come. Of course, we do get significant dips in the Indian market from time to time. When we think about what it is that is likely to really generate the outlook for the really big moves in terms of secular bull markets over the longer term, the rise of technology is certainly sitting out there as a continued bullish catalyst for the foreseeable future. We're living in a golden age of technological innovation, and that is unlikely to change anytime soon. That is being powered ahead by the evolving social interaction, by 5G, by transportation, and by the energy sector. And energy sector is both in terms of storage, production, and renewable energy. So all of those factors are creating this very significant move. Then, of course, you have biotechnology, which really has the potential to cure cancer within the next decade. And just in terms of productive capacity and the removal of a headwind to growth and removal of a massive source of expenditure for national governments, that alone has the potential to create a secular bull market. So we definitely have the scope for really quite profound moves on the upside. But that doesn't mean that secular bull markets don't occasionally get punctuated by bear markets. We've certainly had, and we're certainly in, a continued corrective phase that began a year ago. We've been in a liquidity-fueled market, and therefore this market is highly sensitive to liquidity. And if we do in fact move into a more liquidity-rich environment, then that will contribute to greater enthusiasm. We've had a sufficiently large pullback that there is value now to be had in this market, and we have got some evidence of value investors starting to come back in, and that is a positive. We're still have a lot of work to do in order to put in a higher reaction low and to push back above the trend mean and break sequences of lower rally highs for the wider market. But we are definitely starting to see that coming through in at least some parts of the market, and that is a positive. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.